Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, this is Casey Luskin with the ID the Future podcast here in Seattle, Washington. I have with me Dr. Bill Dembski, a leading theorist of the intelligent design movement, who's going to talk to us today about some of the most common objections to intelligent design. And actually, I've asked Dr. Dembski to help give his rebuttals to the top three objections that he experiences and encounters in this debate. So Dr. Dembski, thank you for being with us today.
Great to be with you.
So the first objection, actually, I shouldn't say is your objection. This is one of my common objections that I encounter. I would say about once a week, I get an email from someone emailing me saying, "Don't you know that you cannot infer design simply because some unlikely event occurs? Unlikely events happen all the time. You deal out a hand of cards, you get an unlikely hand of poker cards. That's an unlikely event, but we don't infer design. Or you toss a handful of pennies on the floor and they're going to arrange themselves in a certain pattern, but that pattern itself is unlikely, but it's not a good reason to infer design." So how do you respond to the objection that mere unlikelihood is not a good reason in and of itself to infer intelligent design?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the objection is right as far as it goes. It just doesn't go far enough. I mean, just brute probability isn't enough to infer design. But I don't think anybody in our movement has ever said that it is. Mm. So, yes, if you flip a coin 1,000 times, you'll witness a highly improbable event. You'll see no pattern there that will lead you to infer design. But if you get a sequence of coin tosses where, you treat the coin tosses as heads as ones, tails as zeros, and you look at the eight-bit blocks, so as ASCII characters, and you get the Shakespearean sonnet that comes out of it, you know that you're dealing with a designed event. Even though that sequence will be as improbable as any other sequence, there's some which will exhibit salient patterns, and it's those salient patterns combined with the improbability that then points us to intelligence. And an example I also give is this search for extraterrestrial intelligence example in the movie Contact. You have this long sequence of prime numbers, highly improbable sequence of bits that comes in, but they're prime numbers. They're mathematically significant numbers. Prime numbers are numbers divisible only by themselves in one. They come in, and the radio astronomers there draw an inference that there is an intelligence behind it. And so, I mean, you've got two hypotheses really working there for you. One, it's that it's the result of some random radio noise. The other is that there's an intelligent source behind it, and the improbability there is crucial. But it's not just the improbability; it's also the patterning of that event, and it's that coincidence of the improbability and then the pattern that then points you to intelligence.
So complexity alone or unlikelihood alone is not enough to infer design. You also have to have a specification or a pattern coupled with the unlikely event, and then you infer design.
That's right. And okay. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, there's a whole apparatus you need to develop, because what is the nature of those patterns that will allow you to do it? Because some patterns won't. I mean, I give an example of movable targets. So you're shooting arrows at movable targets, but the targets, they always move. So wherever you shoot the arrow, the arrow lands squarely in the bullseye. You're matching a pattern, but there's nothing you can infer about the archer and the intelligence or skill, or was it just luck? Was the archer shooting randomly? Because these patterns are matching the event because they've been specifically adapted to it. That's why you want these patterns to be independent in some respect. So that's why at the Olympics, in the Olympic trials, we don't use movable targets. We fix the target, and then the arrows need to be shot. And when they do hit the target, then eventually, if the archer keeps hitting the target, we say, "Hey, here's a skilled archer." And at some point, it becomes, when we attribute skill, that's a design inference. And at some point, it becomes a matter of bad faith to say, "Well, that was just beginner's luck, or that you just got lucky, or it was just chance."
Sure, sure. Okay, well, that's a great answer to that objection. How about the objection that intelligent design cannot be inferred when we find poor design or suboptimal design or evil design? Basically, these arguments of dysteleology, that we cannot infer design when we find certain types of designs in the natural world. Yeah. How do you respond to that objection?
Right. I mean, I think the broad category there is dysteleology, D-Y-S as in dysfunction. And so you've got these examples of design that are in some ways bad. The thing is, we have lots of examples of bad design, drugs that are meant to cure illness that really have a bunch of bad side effects and are worse than what they, you know, produce worse effects than what they cure, that become sources of addiction. Designs can be subverted. In fact, I mean, just in general, design is always an optimization of constraints, and it's hard. I think hard to imagine any design that's optimal in every way imaginable. Mm. I mean, you have what is the optimal coat hanger? Is it one that's strong, that's made out of that's light, you know, it's maybe made out of titanium, but then also you want something that's cheap. You know, if you make use the optimal light strong material, are you going to want to pay for that? So there are always competing objectives with design. But the dysteleology objection does not go to the question of the fact of design. Mm-hmm. You know, just because you have designs that are not perfect or optimal in every respect doesn't mean that you're not dealing with design as such. If you want to, this is, I think, an important point about intelligent design. It's not a theological project. It's a scientific project. It has theological implications. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think as a Christian, then there's something you need to deal with in terms of, you know, if there are bad designs. I mean, there's certain parasites that look really nasty. I mean, that really seem designed to do a number on other organisms, but that then becomes a question for theology. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we reconcile, you know, the designer that we think is behind all of this with the nastiness we're finding in mm-hmm. nature? But that's a further question. That's a question logically downstream. Mm-hmm. You know, we still have to come to terms with the fact of design and with the adequacy of material mechanisms such as Darwinian selection to produce these systems in the first place.
Hmm. Yes, that's very true. I think that my favorite example is from Scott Atran, I believe he's a psychologist at the University of Michigan, who actually said that God, he says, should have given us two heads rather than one. So we have a backup head, and it's bad design. But you know, why stop there? Why not have three heads or four heads or, you know, seven hearts and wings and gills and, you know, a bunch of, you know, feet like a millipede? So, you know, I mean, the thing, what it really comes down to is every one of these projections is someone superimposing their own projection of how the design is supposed to be upon the designer. But none of this goes to the scientific question of whether there is actual design or not. It's simply a matter of, you know, a theological or moral kind of objection to design. Yeah. One other point along these lines is that I think it's dangerous to make the claim that this is poor design, because sometimes what we think is poor design is actually very good design. I'll give you an example. I had an engineer email me recently saying that the blood clotting cascade is this cobbled together string of about, you know, 10 or 12 proteins. And why are so many proteins needed in order to just simply clot your blood? Well, the answer actually came to me from reading Ken Miller, believe it or not, because he gives this evolutionary account of the blood clotting cascade, which is full of leaps and holes and hand waving. But he acknowledges, you know, that each step trying to get these new proteins, well, why would these new proteins give an advantage? Because many of these proteins within the blood clotting cascade allow for a very rapid amplification of the blood clotting cascade process, which actually allows for the blood to clot much faster than it would if you had only a few proteins involved in the blood clotting cascade. So it turns out that, you know, these 10 or 12 proteins are not useless in any way. It's actually a biochemical cascade that the way it's set up allows for very, very rapid clotting, and you have to have them all there if you're going to have, you know, this highly efficient blood clotting cascade that we have. So
I guess, you know, that's why it's called a cascade. I mean, you think of cascades as things, some process that's accelerating, and you need stuff to accelerate.
That's right. So if you think the blood clotting cascade is poorly designed, go read Ken Miller, and maybe it'll change your mind. You know, and I don't think he'll convince you of the evolutionary account either. So, but that's my response on that one. It's dangerous to assume that, you know, just because it looks cobbled together, let's not assume that's just this neo-Darwinian glob of muck. Maybe it actually is designed for a purpose. Let's take one final example here. What about the objection that intelligent design is just repackaged creationism? How do you respond to that?
Well, that's a very standard one. I think you just have to look at the definitions of what we're talking about. Intelligent design is the study of patterns in nature that are best explained as the product of intelligence. So many special sciences fall under intelligent design. The only reason intelligent design is controversial is because it gets applied to biology. We're looking at patterns in biology and saying, hey, it seems that there's good evidence evidence that these patterns are the result of intelligence and are best explained by intelligence and not blind material processes such as Darwinian selection. So that's what intelligent design is. It says nothing about the nature of that intelligence. It could be an alien intelligence. It could be some sort of teleological principle built into nature. It can be a creator god. I mean, all of those are options. And all of those are options that have been considered by proponents of intelligent design in biology. Now, creationism, on the other hand, I mean, I think there are several things that are going on there. I mean, for one thing, if you're a creationist, you hold to a doctrine of creation. So in that sense, all Christians are creationists. And a doctrine of creation is, where did everything come from? You know, and design isn't asking where everything came from. It's asking about patterns in existing things. So one way to distinguish that is, think of a carpenter. A carpenter is producing a piece of furniture, but the carpenter isn't responsible for where the wood came from that made the furniture. So the carpenter is acting as a designer, but a doctrine of creation would say, I mean, a carpenter who is also creator would be responsible for the wood itself, bring that wood into being. And so a carpenter is a designer, is not a creator in general terms. Now, beyond that, though, a creationism, as it's usually used, is also a view of how do you harmonize a certain understanding of Genesis, the creation account in the Bible, with the science of the day. And again, intelligent design has no stake in that debate. It's not into concordism with the Bible. I mean, I have an interest in that, actually, and I may write about this, but not as a design theorist trying to do a scientific program on intelligent design. So usually creationism, you also think of it as a 6-day, 6,000-year Earth. So there's a particular interpretation of Genesis. You know, so intelligent design, there's no stake in treating the Bible as a scientific text. It's not showing any disrespect to the Bible. It's just saying that we can treat the question of whether there's an intelligence behind the world as a purely scientific question without recourse to any religious or philosophical texts. Creationism typically looks to the Bible, tries to harmonize what's seen in Scripture with the science of the day. And often, I mean, I think a lot of the scientific community, one reason they're so concerned about intelligent design is because if they see it as a matter of creationism, well, it seems that creationists often, in their view, take the science of the day and try to pervert it or move it in ways which the scientific community wouldn't allow. At any rate, the intelligent design really sidesteps this whole problem of concordism or harmonization, and it's just when we look at the patterns in nature and infer design for them, where do we go? Well, we can't get to an infinite personal transcendent creator God. What we do is we get an intelligence that's adequate to account for what we see, and this is actually why it's often said that Immanuel Kant, when he critiqued these various proofs for the existence of God, he also dispensed with the argument from design. And he really didn't. What he said about the argument from design, if you read it in his first critique and also in other of his works, he said that the design argument's a good argument, but it only shows you that you have an architect of the world who has to work with existing materials. It does not get you to a creator God who's the source of all being. And I think that's right. So intelligent design, it's much more limited in what it does theologically or philosophically than creationism. In a sense, it gives you something which is also much more defensible than because if it's not staking out as much ground. But on the other hand, I think it is very ambitious in terms of the science it's trying to do, because it's challenging a very dominant scientific view of biological origins, and also challenging a materialistic way of doing science. It's saying that methodological naturalism, the view that science must explain only by undirected natural causes, is false. It's not a good working hypothesis for science.
Well, thank you very much. I think that these will provide some very forceful rebuttals to these common objections, Dr. Dembski, and hopefully this can clear up some misconceptions that maybe even some of our listeners may have about intelligent design. So I appreciate your time and appreciate you going over all this with us today.
Great to be with you, Casey. Always fun.
Okay, well, this is Casey Luskin with the ID the Future podcast signing off. Thanks for listening.
Hello, I'm Bruce Chapman, president of Discovery Institute. The ID the Future podcast you just heard is a crucial part of the mission of the Center for Science and Culture, crucial to keeping you, our friends and supporters, informed about developments in the debate over intelligent design and evolution. Podcasts like Intelligent Design don't just come about through an unguided process or an unfunded process. That's why I'd like to ask you to help support us in whatever way you can. Please consider donating to Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture at discovery.org/CSC. You can also help support us by forwarding this podcast to family and friends and by posting links to intelligentdesign.org and discovery.org on your websites and homepages. Whatever you do, we appreciate it. Thank you.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.